I believe I'm recording as well. Hey, James. Yeah,
all right. So let me get this straight.
Okay.
You ordered a phone mount so that we could do maybe some TikToks.
Correct.
And you have that in your hand.
No, I don't have it in my hand. It's on the kitchen table.
Okay, but it's at hand.
It's here, yeah.
But of the two tripods that you already own.
I already own.
You don't have those at hand.
No, they're in the art barn.
So let's just make sure we understand this properly. Okay. In order for you to have something at hand, you have to order a new version of it from Amazon because it's easier to get a package than go into the barn.
It's interesting you say that because at this point it very well might be. I opened the barn. Well, I call it a barn. It's just it's a shed, basically.
Yeah, I get it. It's a shed.
Yeah, you get it. And there are so many body parts in there. That sounds bad. There's
yes,
so many mannequins.
That does sound bad.
There's so many pieces of mannequins. I have mannequins galore. I told you about all the body parts of the mannequins. I have full-size mannequins, torsos, mannequins, heads and arms and legs. And I have to take that all out to get to the shelving unit that's in the back where these – I could see them. I just can't access them without moving. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Try to get in there yesterday. I was exhausted, James. Have empathy.
I should have empathy. I just can't. I can't seem to find any right now.
I know.
Just go into the barn or the shed. Do it. Just do it. Commit, Catherine. I want you to commit.
I'll commit after this.
Just go in and say, I'm getting out of this with a tripod in my hand or I'm not getting out of this.
I might not get. You'll find my calcified torso. In there amongst the...
Just the torso?
I don't know. Maybe the birds or...
See, this is part of the problem, Catherine. You really need to have a plan before you go in. Bring the whole body. The legs make getting the torso around a lot easier. If you just go in the torso, yeah, it's going to make it a lot harder to get the
tripod. I know. I'm so pathetic. I got groceries yesterday and it took me till 2 in the morning to unpack.
Okay.
Just getting bad over here.
More body parts?
No, it was a bunch of zucchini.
Don't ask. I don't know how to talk to you.
Well, good morning. At least I'm getting some coffee on board, so I'll be better. I'll be better in a minute. I was looking for that article I sent you.
Preparation?
Yeah, well, I got up 10 minutes ago. I was up putting stuff in crock pots and cleaning zucchini. Yeah, I washed it. I'm going to make some zucchini bread. I'll bring you one if you like it. I have organic dates.
My wife used to make zucchini bread and it was quite good.
Mine's quite good. Did you see the article I sent?
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I didn't realize, even though I looked at it again, I was like, oh, she actually said this was the artist of the week, and I didn't register it at the time, because you sent it the day after we did our last podcast. I'm not ready for new information at that point.
Oh, God, I'm trying to send them late. Go ahead, I know.
No. Well, you have been a little bit slower in the past, but you turned around on everything this week very, very quickly. See? You can't. I don't want to take any more of this nonsense from you. It's like, oh, it's too much work. I've got too much stuff. You got the show notes out. Basically, you turned on a dime with those. I sent them to you. You had them then before the next day, less than
probably
12 hours later. Probably even
less than
12 hours.
I think it was 8 hours. Yeah, it was done.
And you sent me the audio again immediately.
Right. Now that I know how to do it.
So, Catherine,
yes,
you can do this stuff.
I can do it.
So I'm not taking any more of your guff. I know you can do it, so I'm going to expect you to do it. So I want a tripod next week, and I want your new headphones.
Yeah, the headphones. So we nixed the Beat. I just liked how they looked, but I didn't know if it was worth the extra
$100. Of course it's not worth it.
It wasn't worth the extra $110.
The extra $110.
I think those were only, maybe it was $140. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, most Beats I think are $300 or $350.
Yeah, the plug-in ones were cheaper. And so I called Apple and she's like, oh, yeah, we got those. Maybe they only had blue and stuff. I don't know whatever, but I just didn't think it was worth it. I didn't order it.
Yeah, don't. The long and the short is don't buy Beats unless you have money coming out of your ears and you like the way they look. Don't buy Beats.
I don't have money coming out of any orifice.
That's probably healthy. What's less healthy, though, is reading the BBC.
Okay, talk while I'm perusing. What happened?
Perusing what? What are you perusing?
I'm trying to find that article. Go ahead. I can't remember the artist's
name.
On Chase, yeah.
You don't remember the artist you sent me.
I'm only half a cup in.
This feels
keep going.
A farce. Is this really happening right now?
Yes, it's happening.
Boy. See, I was
it's
I
almost Halloween.
That you would be bringing all the content since you picked the quote artist of the week. And by the way, I know this, I didn't never mention this. I just assumed it was implied that I assumed we would be picking artists that were alive.
Oh, I didn't know.
Well, I know you didn't know, but it seemed like mine was alive last week.
Oh, I didn't know that. I just was thinking still about spooky.
But you and your corpses, you brought a dead one.
I brought a dead one, and that the painting. And I was trying to segue into another segment, but you know.
I was trying to segue back into Banksy. But you know how do you turn Banksy into a bad news story? How do you do that, Catherine?
Banksy, he's a good news story.
Do you remember 3 years ago at a Sotheby's auction? I think it was a Sotheby's, maybe it was Christie's, one of them. When a very rare Banksy painting came up, because he doesn't generally sell his work like that.
Right, right, right.
And as soon as the gavel went down on the sale, the piece shredded itself.
Yes, I remember that.
Well, unfortunately, it failed midway through. So the idea was he had built in a shredding machine in this very elaborate frame in which the painting was presented. So unbeknownst to Sotheby's or anybody in the buying-selling chain, aside from Banksy and his team of creators, as soon as the gavel went down, they activated it, and there's a built-in shredding device concealed within the frame, and it started to shred itself. Unfortunately, it stopped midway down because it failed. Now, Banksy had actually a video that went with this showing that he had tested it several times and hadn't failed. So it was meant to shred the whole painting, but it stopped halfway through, unfortunately.
Right.
Guess what just got sold again this week?
I saw they were selling it again. It did get sold?
Yes.
The shredded piece?
For $16.8 million.
That is so crazy, James. It's beyond crazy.
It's beyond explanation.
I have a couple thoughts on that. And I understand Banksy's, but like his vibe. And it was a performance piece as well as it was whatever. And he's like shitting on the art world. And like he spent a lot of money. And
yeah, I wouldn't say it's a performance piece.
I don't know. I thought possibly part of it was, you know.
I thought of it as a commentary.
Well, commentary. Maybe like a political performance piece, commentary. I don't know. I like the term performance. But anyway.
Yeah, performance is great if you're playing the guitar or singing or dancing or something.
Right, but it was
not
just
if you're
like,
shredding a painting.
No, and it really pissed me off that he did that. I mean, my first impulse was that, because I liked the piece. I liked the image a lot. It was the little girl with the balloon. And
he can paint it. He can paint it again.
Yeah, he can paint it again, but it's just
sacred
the whole
about the painting.
My first gut reaction was piss me off. And then I thought, well, the person who bought it has so much flipping money. You know, what difference does it make? I get what he's doing. Ha, ha, ha. And then instantaneously to the shredding, oh my God, the painting's worth so much more now. I mean, they went there within a nanosecond of the shock and horror of this action.
Right, they spun it out immediately. It's like, oh,
immediately. It was like the next breath.
You bought this painting, but no, now it's actually a performance piece.
Exactly. Instead of being like, oh shit, I just spent X million or what, I can't remember the original cost of that.
I think it was two.
It's like, instead of being like, oh shit, he just ruined like my investment and I haven't even gotten the money out of my wallet yet, or it's not been Venmo'd to you yet, or whatever.
Well, that would have been the interesting thing. I think Sotheby's, their spin mode immediately kicked in and they had to say that it was worth more. Otherwise, what were they going to do? The purchaser has purchased an artwork, which technically on the hook for it, because once the gavel goes down, you own it. But then before it transfers ownership from the auction house to the buyer, the painting gets destroyed. So who's on the hook for that?
Well, that was my question. Yeah.
Does the artist get paid? Does Sotheby's have to, you know, cancel the sale? You know, but they immediately turn around and say, oh, no, it's worth even more now. You're so lucky. You're so lucky to have a destroyed piece of artwork.
Would you want that? Where do you put something like that with the shredder in a bin under it and the piece? And my question, do you think, and I've always had some suspicion about this, do you really think it was a failed attempt at the shredder? The shredder just got blocked at that instant? Or was that the actual intent?
No, I believe Banksy when he says that it was a malfunction, that he had fully intended for it to completely shred. And shredding it is a hard word. It is shredding it, but it's cutting into small strips. So it's not like it's completely masticating the thing and destroying it completely. You would have had a pile of painted strips or canvas strips at the bottom.
Which would be actually a cool piece. Well. We could maybe do a whole installation of that.
No, it wouldn't have been. No.
No, I'm kidding.
Okay.
That would have been maybe to me more aesthetically pleasing than seeing this thing going through the shredder. It's like seeing that constantly happening.
The only part that I'm curious about is how the curators would have handled a pile of shredded canvas. It's like, did they have to replicate exactly how it fell the first time, or can they just kind of dump the pile on the ground underneath the frame when they're displaying it?
Good question.
So I'm just glad that the curators didn't have to go through that difficult struggle.
That is a good point, because that would have caused a lot of angst, and transporting that pile of shred would have been even more miserable.
And can we have just a moment of concern for the curators who have to deal with all this? Oh, those poor curators.
Mm-hmm.
Come.
Right.
But can you imagine buying a piece of artwork for $2 million?
I can't even imagine.
Especially one that you can literally go and see somewhere on a wall someplace, and probably in London. It's wall art.
Yeah, it's very cute wall art. And I think it would be better outside. I think that'd be so cute outside on a wall.
I think the end of the article was really nice, because I think anybody who is curious about what is modern art, I don't understand this. Mm-hmm. The end of this article explains it, and I'm just going to read it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, read it.
Former BBC Arts editor Will Gompertz.
Uh-huh.
His name is Gompertz. I don't know how you get through your life with a name like that, but okay, that's fine.
Okay.
Wrote at the time that he believed Love is in the Bin, which is the title of the piece, would go on to be seen as, quote, one of the most significant artworks of the early 21st century. It is not a great painting that can be compared to a late Rembrandt or a sculpture mm-hmm, to sit mm-hmm. alongside Michelangelo's David, but in terms of conceptual art, emanating from Duchamp's Dadaist sensibility, it's Jesus. Exceptional, he added. And then he goes on, next paragraph is, it was brilliant in both conception and execution. Well, I mean,
now,
obviously not in the execution, because it failed.
Then
just a few more sentences.
Go ahead.
What is love? And again, this is the title of the painting. What is Love is in the Bin? He asked. Is it a painting, or is it now a piece of conceptual art? Or should it be classified as sculpture? Or is it rubbish? Who decides? Who knows? Duchamp would say it is up to you to decide. So who's to say what it is?
Who's to say?
You know, if you can't figure out what it is, it probably doesn't have any value.
I'm rarely rendered speechless.
This is the art world. Basically, you know, the emperor has no clothes.
The emperor had no frame in this case.
Oh, it had a frame.
Oh, it did?
Yeah.
How did he shred it without the... Oh, it did. It shredded through the frame, right?
Well, the shredder was concealed within the frame. Very Jesus. Clever, by the way. Oh, and there is an accompanying video that Banksy put out for the original sale.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just beautiful, because he's got some hidden cameras that's going into Sotheby's, the auction house, mm-hmm. before the auction, and he gets all these really wealthy arts people on camera looking so dumb and stupid and just being the most vapid, empty-headed people in the world. I don't know. I can't imagine a place less intellectually stimulating than what he showed on his film.
I just think it's crap.
So 16.8 million, let's just say 16 million pounds. Just imagine this for a moment. 16 million pounds. You could buy one piece of artwork for 16 million pounds, mm-hmm. or you could finance 160 artists at 100,000 pounds a year.
Mm-hmm.
For a year. You could pay 100, you could find 160 artists to pay $100,000 a year to create work for you. I think you'd probably be better off hiring 160 painters or artists for a year's worth of their work. I think you get a lot more return on your investment there.
I do too.
Not even to question the quantity of artwork you get. You probably also get better artwork.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. No, I always thought that it wasn't a malfunction. I think that they spun it because they didn't know what else to do with it.
Well, it caught them off guard. They didn't know what was going to happen.
It's a travesty.
And it was a malfunction as far as not completing the shredding.
Right. Wow.
There is a universe out there, you know, if you believe in quantum mechanics, there is a universe out there which it did completely shred. You don't know multiple universe theory?
I think I read about some of that a while ago.
It doesn't matter. It's rubbish. Don't worry about it.
It's rubbish. Speaking of the universe.
Yes.
William Shatner went into space this week.
Yeah, sort of.
Right. He was very moved.
It's like a groundhog sticking his head up and then coming right back down. It's like, good. Did he really go out? You know, if a groundhog sticks his head up out of the ground and then immediately goes back down, did he really go outside? You know,
my dad's like, is he still out there? And I'm like, no, I think they came back. I think they just went up and down. I said, it's a carnival ride, basically.
Yes, that's a good analogy. I mean, if you tell your kid to go out and play and go outside and play, and he goes out, he stands outside on the porch for 30 seconds and comes back in, that doesn't really count as going and playing outside.
Right. Yeah. I
wouldn't go up with Blue Origin. That's just a complete waste of time. If Elon said, hey, man, we're going to send our crew up again and they're going to go around the planet 12 times or I don't know, like half a dozen mm-hmm. or a dozen times, you're actually really in space and you're actually really going around the Earth. It's like actually being in space. It's instead of just going up on a pop rocket and then coming right back down.
Well, it reminded me of like, remember these, I don't know, I haven't been to Vegas in a while, but when they put in those roller coasters or that thing, you know, and just, it just kind of reminded me of like a Vegas ride. Like
you don't even know the name of the ride, do you?
I don't, because I blocked it all out.
They have one of those that goes straight up and back down, which I would never go on because...
Yeah, go straight up. And
I don't do that kind of thing.
I don't do that.
But they have one. They have one on the top of one of the buildings, which you
exactly.
know,
that's what I was thinking.
No way. Sorry.
Yeah, next. It was down by the. Yeah, that was down by the Trump Tower. I think it was that.
No, it wasn't the Trump Tower. I'm sure.
No, it wasn't the Trump Tower. It was down in that section of Vegas. I'm like, no way. It just reminded me of that, a bit.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Up and down.
Up and down. No, I just thought it was interesting because I do like William Shatner. We talked about Star Trek last time briefly.
Well, this is a Star Trek show.
It is now, and I'm duly. I'm
not now since the beginning. It's taking us a while to get going on it. But okay. William Shatner is not exactly the best actor in the world. I mean, he's fine, but he's a little bit. I guess all actors are probably narcissists, but I don't know. Maybe I remember T.J. Hooker too clearly.
Oh my gosh.
And his toupees, or whatever the hell he's been doing with his hair.
I didn't even think about that.
And he did fine for Kirk. He was okay with Kirk, generally speaking. I think there could have been better Kirks. Here's my fantasy. Do you want to hear my fantasy?
I do. I want to hear it all. Yes.
You ready? Who should have played Kirk in the original? Sean Connery.
Oh, good one.
Blown your freaking mind. Sean Connery as Captain Kirk. Can you imagine? Because here's the thing. You have Spock and Sean Connery standing there. The problem with Shatner is that he's not a big guy. He was athletic and he was fit in that series, but was a little bit of a little guy, not a huge guy.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Connery has a huge presence. He's a big, beautiful man. You know, Spock is supposed to be a Vulcan. Vulcans are stronger, smarter, faster than humans, and I think that would have been heightened if you'd had a larger male captain standing next to him. That's just one point. But I think he would have embodied that idea of an adventurer a lot more physically than Shatner was able to.
That's, I think, where I said it was hammy. And I don't want to knock his acting, but a lot of it.
You should knock it if you think it was, if it's knock worthy.
Well, sometimes it wasn't. And I found the other characters wasn't worthy. It wasn't that compelling. And I found the other character, like Uhura, I found more compelling than Shatner half the time.
I watched the episode where there is an evil universe and they get flipped. So an evil Kirk winds up on the good Enterprise and the good Kirk winds up on the evil Enterprise.
Ah.
And we see an evil Uhura. And the way they distinguish between who's good and who's evil, if you're evil, you have a goatee, you know, a partial beard.
Like me.
Oh, so this is how you know that I'm from the evil universe.
I'm scared.
But if
now.
You're a woman, they basically show your midriff. They expose your midriff. So you see Uhura with a midriff. And if you imagine Uhura, Nichelle Nichols, she is a curvy lady.
Mm-hmm.
But then I remember my mouth fell open when I saw her with her midriff exposed because I remember her with those big curvy hips, but then her belly was completely flat.
Wow.
So her curvature is, she's curvy in great places and flat in great places. It just blew my mind. And that's kind of when I really fell in love with her. Or love might be the wrong word, but we'll just go with love.
I always thought she was beautiful and I loved the character. And I always wished to see more of her on screen. And it was always just such a filler with some of those characters, you know.
Yeah, and there were cringeworthy moments. I mean, part of this is Shatner not being the greatest actor in the world, but part of it is what he was asked to play. He's standing there in front of the camera, and they're saying, okay, now imagine there's a pain ray beaming on you. So you have to stand there and stand within the camera confines and act like you're being imaginably tortured by something that you can't see. Those were painful scenes to watch. But again, it's... I don't know how I would do that.
I couldn't be an actor. Maybe I could. I don't know. I've often wondered.
I don't know. Have you seen some of the actors? I could be an actor, just not a good actor.
And I think you'd be a fairly decent actor.
No, I don't think so. I think I wouldn't be. But I could be wrong. Give me a shot. Give me $1 million to play something in the next something or another.
Okay. I'm like, okay, like I have the backing for anything right now.
When I really sit down and think about it, Shatner just seemed like kind of a weird casting call for that position. Because like I said, I think they needed someone a little bit more physical for the role.
You know, now that I'm thinking about it, I think you're absolutely correct in your assessment. I never put that much time or effort into thinking about Star Trek, but I agree with
you. Well, you should. That is a damn failing on your part.
Well, how did you think of the castings of the newer, like as they moved on with the newer generation and all of the iterations of Star Trek?
Well, that's a point that I wanted to make is I don't think you have to be a big burly guy to be captain of the starship. I think Voyager, who's captained by Captain Janeway, Catherine Janeway, she was not burly, but she was very fit, but she was not a big burly guy. She was a great captain, not my favorite, but a great captain. Now, you also had Captain Sisko, who was really amazing. He was a big burly black guy who had an amazing presence. Depends on the character. The new Captain Kirk from the newer movies, I say new, it's like over 10 years old now, but the reboot from the movies is also not a big guy, but he had a different vibe. He had a different kind of character and different kind of vibe. So I think he worked really well in his role.
Okay. I just keep thinking of the, who was the Jean-Luc Picard one?
Patrick Stewart.
Stewart. Yes,
Sir
thank you.
Patrick Stewart.
Yes, thank you. Because that's when I recall when it was on, I was involved with someone who evidently was a Trekkie, and he would turn that on, and I'd be forced to watch it.
Forced. Oh, I'm so sorry that you were forced to watch it.
When did they air? Because it seems like a long time ago.
Late 80s. Yeah, they started
in the 80s. It was past the 80s, so they were reruns.
And they had 7 seasons, I think, and so they ran into the 90s.
Okay.
And then they're still on reruns now.
Whenever it was, it wasn't the 80s for darn sure. I was like, oh, I found him mild. And he is not a huge guy. And I thought his presence, if I had to compare Captain Kirk from the OG days to Picard's character, I would have preferred Picard.
Yeah, I mean, we can get into a whole discussion of who's your favorite captain. And I wouldn't discount Kirk as one of my favorite captains. I probably wouldn't put him. I probably would take Sisko because Sisko was such a badass. It's also easier to like Sisko because he's such a more developed character. One of the problems I have with Star Trek, I promise we'll stop talking about Star Trek in just a moment. But one of the problems I have with Star Trek and most of the series is that it's really hard to take them seriously because no one has any serious relationships in it. Once in a while you see someone's kid, and usually it's just very superficial. No one has any serious relationships until you get to Deep Space Nine, which is where Captain Sisko is the captain, actually eventually becomes the captain.
Yeah.
And he has serious relationships. He's got an ongoing relationship with his son. So he's just a much more developed character, but he's also a complete badass. I mean, I don't want to give away stuff, but...
Don't give it away.
He does things that are not in keeping with Star Trek or the Federation guidelines. He steps well outside of his bounds on a number of occasions.
I see. Okay. He goes rogue a bit, huh?
Yes. He's very roguish.
I never saw one of those movies ever.
That's not a movie. Deep Space Nine is a TV show.
Oh, that either. I know. Rolling your eyes, shaking your head. I see it all.
It's so hard to be.
It's so hard to be.
When will I get the co-host that I deserve?
I think you probably have them. Tell me about the co-host.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I have exactly the co-host that I deserve.
I know you were bemoaning both of your co-hosts earlier.
Shh, don't say that. Christopher might be listening.
Christopher knows. He knows.
Christopher, all I'm saying is catch up on the old episodes. I want to publish them. We have them recorded. We just need to publish them.
It wasn't anything bad, Christopher. He adores you.
Well, that's a little bit bad.
He adores you, Christopher.
Okay, let's not go that far.
Okay. Yeah, we won't go there.
In other news, Artist of the Week.
Artist of the Week.
You had a pick this week.
William Merritt Chase.
That seemed like it was out of left field.
It was, but okay, let me tell you my backstory. I was still in the spooky zone, and I kept thinking about the picture, the White Rose, a.k.a. Miss Jessup. And this will be really quick, Artist of the Week.
Okay.
And the White Rose, a.k.a. Miss Jessup, is a very large piece by William Merritt Chase that hangs in the Phoenix Art Museum. And many, many, many years ago, when I perused the galleries, and I remember just standing in front of this picture, and it actually spurred me to try to learn how to use pastels better. And I was just taken with it. It doesn't look like much when you're looking at it like on a screen. But if you stand in front of this piece, it is truly one of the most ethereal pieces. I mean, it grabbed me in. I went back and sat in front of it. I just was taken with it. And every time I go to the museum, I do a little trip to see her. And just the draping, you know, on her, the way he's done it is just beautiful. You can almost feel rustling in the fabric. He had done a lot of portraiture with women in clothing. And then as I dug deeper, I realized that he had started the Parsons School of Design in New York.
You know I went to RISD, right?
Yeah, you say it a bit. Yeah. Sorry, I love
oh,
that.
Yes. I went to RISD. You must respect me. I hardly ever bring it up. But how am I not supposed to bring it up now? I mean, Parsons is like our archenemy. How can you bring them up?
Well, because I watched Project Runway.
It's not archenemy. So what does that have to do with anything?
The original Project Runways were, they did stuff at Parsons.
I did not know that. Mm-hmm. Well, bad on them. Shame on, no there's, I love Parsons. I just, it is, there is a mild, I guess some people think there's a rivalry. I don't. I think people, you know, we're in the same industry. Mm-hmm. We do the same thing. I think it's great. I love all the art schools. And I've been to several of mm-hmm. them. So, you know, there's that.
So anyway, that was my take.
So right you fell in love with one of his paintings.
I fell in love with that painting.
I would say most of his portraiture is a little bit dull, in my opinion, because I think that's basically just his day job. That's probably how he's getting paid day to day, is just doing portraiture.
Right, right. Yeah, it's nothing compelling that you'd look at, but and again, like seeing it on the screen. But if you stand in front of this piece, I will visit her again. I just think it's ethereal. It kind of scared me. It almost looked like a woman in white coming out of the wall. You know, that's when I started thinking like haunted, spooky stuff. And this wasn't meant to be haunted or spooky or anything, but it has such a quality. Like I could see her floating down. Like she'd be the best ghost in any movie or anything.
Well, she's not an aggressive ghost. She's more of...
sad.
What's that?
She looks sad. She looks sad to me.
Yeah, she'd be not necessarily a tormented soul, but a soul that is drifting in melancholy.
Right, melancholy and regretful. I see some regret on that face. A little regret.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think there's enough sensitivity in Hollywood to make a movie like that.
Right. But anyway, that was my take. That was my artist of the week. That's all I got.
You know, she'd have to blow up or something.
Oh, they'd have to float her and then blow her up. And then the wafting pieces of that fabric would just have to slowly drift away from her like an implosion. And you just see her head rolling to the left.
Oh, nice.
And then the torso. And then like the little pieces of fabric.
You just always go to the torsos, don't you? You want disembodied, disembodied bodies.
I found a torso in my spare room that I had gessoed and painted.
You know, you claim that I talk about RISD all the time. I am... A little bit.
I didn't claim.
Yeah, you mentioned it like 2 minutes ago.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
But, you know, the number of torso findings that I have to deal with on this show.
I know. I'm telling you, it was out of control.
It's horrifying.
It is horrifying. You haven't seen it in real life. You will soon.
Oh, goody. Can't wait.
Yeah.
So anyway, my take on William Merritt Chase was that he's,
give me your take.
You know, a late 19th century American Impressionists. And
exactly.
For my money, I think the American Impressionists were better than the French Impressionists. I think they do a lot better job of capturing the scenes and the light. And I think William Merritt Chase, I don't have an encyclopedic understanding of his work, but I perused some of his works, and I found several that were quite engaging. Including this one portrait that I'm looking at, which is probably, again, this is his day job. Bessie Potter, which is an interesting one because it's very dark. It looks kind of unfinished. I mean, there's most of the painting is black. I'd say 80% of the canvas is covered in black paint and with barely any details. There is the woman's face does come out and it's in shadow, but the way he captures the light on it, I thought was quite exceptional because this is what I feel when I see a lot of his works is I can really kind of feel the atmosphere of the room or the area that he's in. And that's, I think, where his brilliance really comes in. This is just a very simple portrait with very barely lit, but it captures the light bouncing off her shoulder and barely illuminating the rest of her face. Mm-hmm. And it's such a masterful, I can feel, like I said, I don't know. I don't know what else to say other than I can actually feel the atmosphere in his paintings. Mm-hmm. He paints light remarkably well.
He does.
And I have several other examples of basically that, but in different settings. Like there's one in a rowboat, and he captures this lighting sense where it's such a rare moment. It's like twilight after a storm, you know, where it's starting to get dark.
Yes.
And you have some leftover atmospheric stuff from a storm. So there's a little bit of gold in the atmosphere. There's some pinks and some, and it's also getting dim. And it's also, but there's not a lot of sharp shadows because mm-hmm. it's all reflecting. And that's basically, and then he goes from that to, he's got some seaside paintings, which are just wonderful encapsulations of that, the air of a New England beach. You can feel mm-hmm. the air.
Yes.
I feel like I'm saying the same thing over and over again, but he's a painter of light.
No, you're not. He is a painter of light, which was the whole deal with Impressionists.
Yeah.
I almost said Expressionists. Oh, my God. Coffee. Give me coffee. The Impressionists.
Well, so. I think he's a lot of expression in his paintings in some of them, so... Sure. Let's call him an expressionist too, because who's gonna stop us?
Who's gonna stop us? No one. They should stop us.
So you mentioned that he also founded the Parsons School.
Correct.
I looked into that because you actually sent me a history of the Parsons School, which is done by Parsons School. So yes, it sounded a little bit self-aggrandizing. I'm like, I'm reading all through the things, quote these amazing breakthroughs that they did in the early teens, in the '20s, and the '30s, and the '40s. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, okay, that's great, but it's not like these were the first people to do all these different techniques and teaching things. It was happening concurrently all around the world. I don't know mm-hmm. if you guys know this little thing called the Bauhaus in Germany, but they were basically doing the same thing until they got shut down by the goddamn Nazis.
Right.
No, I'm not trying to take anything away from Parsons. Being on that wave, being on the cusp of the transition from transitioning craft from one-off pieces into crafting mass-produced pieces and mm-hmm. graphic design, the birth of graphic design, industrial design, fashion design, all these things were very mm-hmm. important. And Parsons was right there on the wave. I'm not saying they were either
they
leading
weren't
the
only ones, right.
or at the back of the wave. They were right there on the forefront.
Right.
But I really enjoyed reading that because...
The birth of socially active design.
So it is called the Parsons School. So that was one of the other founders who came in later. So it's not the mm-hmm. Chase School.
It's not the Chase School, which I thought was interesting. That's why I didn't know that. I didn't even know that.
Oh, right.
Did you know that?
No, I don't care.
I know you don't care, but I just thought, well,
Catherine, I don't know if you knew this, but I went to the Rhode Island School of Design.
No, I didn't know that.
Well, I'm glad I could educate you on that.
Okay. I went to ASU.
Super. Yeah, well, my school was founded by a bunch of women.
My school taught me how to drink beer, like plain quarters and starting the weekend on Thursday with 2-for-1 happy hour.
I am deeply unimpressed.
Oh, you should be.
So the last sentence of this history of Parsons really piqued my interest. And I love, if I could have sex with a paragraph, I would have sex with this paragraph.
Oh my God.
Because this is totally right up my alley.
Okay, go for
it. This is it. From the Parsons history. Mm-hmm. And this is basically bringing it from the past and bringing it into what's happening now. So it says... The establishment of the Making Center in 2016, a spacious 26,000 square foot state-of-the-art facility, furthers Parsons' mission to foster transdisciplinary, okay, that's the only part I don't like, transdisciplinary isn't really, really a word, but transdisciplinary creativity by bringing together students from across the school in a single making space. This spirit of interdisciplinary collaboration is also expressed by Parsons' growing list of new master's programs that emphasize learning in hybrid emerging fields, including data visualization, digital products, design and business, and fashion management. The reason I love that so much is because I love maker spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea that they've jammed them all together. Because when I was at... Did you know I went to RISD? Because I went to RISD. When I was at
RISD... Did you? Oh, okay, tell me about RISD. This is the first...
One of the great things about it was that the Metcalf building, at the time, the Metcalf building was basically 5 or 6 stories, and every level was mm-hmm. a different department. So as you went mm-hmm. up through the building, you would walk through different departments like ceramics and light metals and industrial design and sculpture and mm-hmm. glass.
Mm-hmm.
And
nice.
There was just, because I was in there every day, I met all the other students who I saw what they were working on, and we collaborated on a bunch of stuff just because we were shoulder to shoulder to each other. So this idea that they have this maker space and it's all cramming everyone together, I think mm-hmm. is just the best kind of school. I wish it wasn't exclusive to the high-end art schools like this, though. I wish mm-hmm. every community mm-hmm. college had 26,000 square feet of maker space.
That would be so fantastic. Because there is something about that synergy being with artists who are working in media that's outside of your expertise or your interest. And when I had a brief time when I was at a studio here in Phoenix... with the space, and we did all kinds of weird craft and different things. I wasn't painting there at the time, There were painters. There were one guy was a sign painter. One guy did stuff with airbrushes. I mean, there was a lot of different. But there was a photographer at one point. And just to see the different things that everyone was doing, it really gave some interesting, I don't know if synergy is the right word, but it
was. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And, you know, it really was a synergistic. So when we'd open up for First Friday, and I was the, you know, I'd just go to AJ's and buy a bunch of food, and we'd all have a meal together and just talk about the work and then walk studio to studio to see what people would be presenting or if they were working on something, because it was a working studio space. So we would do like the whole First Friday often was demonstration. And it was just so interesting. It was just really a very special time. And that was like my toe into the art world, actually being around other artists. It really motivated me. And I often think back to that space and I wish that I could recreate it.
There's so much energy that comes from things like that.
Yes.
And when you're in that environment, you don't even necessarily need professors, because the students are in there working on one thing and another student comes over and says, oh, what are you doing? And they start interacting and they start generating new ideas and they start basically building a collaborative process on their own.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, the second part of that is, you know, looking into new fields, the emerging field, data visualization. How does that impact digital design or physical design or you know, digital products? You know, they're not afraid to start looking at new areas, and they're not just sticking to the old graphic design, industrial design, fashion design, the old tropes. They're looking at new things. I found that really interesting. And then, of course, I had to look at the Making Space itself, and the Making Space just blew my mind. I love this thing. I wish I could live there.
I knew you were going to say that.
I don't care if you guys can deal with this or not, but I'm going to go through the labs and studios that are part of the Making Space. It says, this starts with alternative process for darkroom. I don't know what that means, but it looks cool.
Okay.
Books. They have a books art studio, which means basically binding books. And this may sound trivial, but making books is its own art form. And it is
it
an
is
amazing
its own
process,
art form.
Which can be used for more than just books. Casting room, and their casting room is mostly for plastic casting, like resin casting, but it's amazing that they have a space dedicated to that, because if you have a space dedicated to that, it becomes so much easier to actually do it. Ceramics and wet shop, CNC machine shop, dark room, digital knit lab. Don't know what that is, other than, you know, obviously they've digitized a knitting machine. That's amazing. I'd love to see the shit that's coming out of there.
Me too.
Digital photo labs, that's fairly self-explanatory.
Right.
Embroidery hub. Did your college have an embroidery hub? If not, go to a different college. If you don't have an embroidery hub, you fail.
You fail.
As a college, university, any kind of learning institution. Laser lab, where they use laser cutters. And energy lab. That didn't immediately explain what it was, but apparently their architecture students have this whole lab set up so they can look at how light affects buildings, like the sun, the rotation of the earth and the sun and as we move through the season, so they can place a building at a latitude and longitude and see how it's going to be affected by the sun over the course of a year. And I fell in love with that. Is exactly what architecture should be doing. Machine knitting studio. Metal shop, motion capture studio. So if you need to capture motion, just go into the lab. Open light lab. I don't know what that is. Who cares? Photo shooting studios, physical computing.
Oh, that'd be cool.
3D printing lab. Well, of course, 3D printing. Printing studio, like regular, you know, lithographs and whatnot. Prototyping shop. If you have all the shops under the sun, you want a prototyping shop, which is like a catch-all for everything else that you don't have. And then one of my favorites, specialty sewing lab.
Wow.
Oh, wait. I said one of my favorites. Another next one, they have a shoemaking lab.
No.
Yeah. And the last two would be weaving and dye lab. And the last one is a wood shop.
That's very interesting. I'm glad you dug so deep.
I didn't go that deep. Yeah,
no, don't be sorry. No, I think it's fascinating. And I want to live there now.
I love it. I want more.
Can we set up a little tent under one of the tables and just live there?
Parsons, good stuff.
There's nothing like that in Phoenix, is there?
We do have Maker Labs in the ASU.
Yeah, we do have Maker Labs. Yeah.
ASU has a big one downtown, but I haven't been there yet because, you know, COVID.
COVID, yeah, that's just gotten in the way of everything.
Yeah, stupid mess. Stupid, yeah, COVID. Well, that was one thing Chris asked me. Is COVID still a thing? Do people still worry about that? It's like, yeah. Since people are still dying, getting 100,000 per day or something like that. Or is it week or per day?
I don't know.
What a week.
Yeah. COVID is still a thing.
Yes, it is still a thing. It is hopefully dying out, but it's still a thing.
I think it's going to be a thing for the duration of our existence on this planet.
Well, it is. I mean, it's an ongoing thing, but once we, well, I was going to say, once we get to 70-80% vaccination, of course, we'll never get there, as the United States will never get there. But
no, Maricopa County sure as hell won't.
We'll eventually just put our blinders on and open up like normal. I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but you know, Spain's open up again. Australia's open up again. And they're like, yay, everything's back to normal because they reached 70-80% vaccination rates because people aren't stupid.
Right. And at the end of October, I read last night that South Korea is going to withdraw some of their really intense restrictions in terms of like gatherings and opening bars and community spaces. So.
Yeah, it's happening everywhere. It's happening everywhere else.
Right. And they started so much later. I mean, they were not, you know, the vaccine wasn't as readily accessible in a lot of these places as it was here. And they just went, okay, fine, we'll do it.
And the people complaining that, oh, with all these lockdowns and kids having to wear masks and whatnot. Well, you know, if you all got vaccinated, we could stop that right now. Just get vaccinated. This is the simplest thing in the world. Just if you're tired of this lockdown stuff, get vaccinated. Such a simple answer.
I don't know why did it have to become such a thing? Why? I mean,
it's all political now.
It's all political. It's just so stupid.
It's been, you know, I've seen this pointed out over and over again, and I hate to dump on one party over the other because both parties are pretty extreme.
Dump. It doesn't matter.
But
yeah.
The Republicans' modern platform is find out what the liberals believe and just take 180-degree opposition to it, regardless of what it is.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's like that mindset just reminds me of an oppositional pre-adolescent or something. Someone who needs like residential treatment.
Well, you know, I wouldn't
their
put
behavior
this
behavior challenges.
Don't put this on the adolescents and the pre.
No, no. I mean, no, not like, you know, you can erase that, but it's like an oppositional.
I'm just saying because there are plenty of adults that are like that, as we can see, that are part of the Republican Party.
But I think it's a childlike mentality. This is not.
No, I wouldn't say it's childlike.
You don't think so?
It's
like an oppositional defiant disorder. Just take it right out of the DSM.
Well, there's that. Okay, Miss DS, whatever you just said.
I don't know what version that
you educated people.
It's like a oppositional defiant disorder.
They're intentionally uninformed.
Yes, they
okay,
just.
So we got the art in. We got the ridiculous art in. We got the good artwork in, and we got our COVID bashing in.
I think, are we done?
I think we're about done, unless you have anything else to talk about.